Hey, how's it going? I'm Nick, the host of the Echo Academy podcast, a podcast where we tap into the world's collective wisdom and experience to learn how we can be more resilient. In this episode, I speak with stand-up comedian and host of the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast, Paul Gilmartin. I wanted to have a conversation with Paul about his mental health challenges and what drives him to tell his story so openly and honestly. One of my favorite quotes from Paul was, "The more difficult it is to talk about, the more valuable it is for people to hear it." I definitely recommend his podcast. But for now, without further ado, here's my conversation with Paul Gilmartin. So I suppose, you know, a good way to really just kick off this conversation and this podcast is really just to understand. I mean, you're a comedian, you're an entertainer. I mean, how did you get started in comedy, and, you know, when did you realize?
I remember the first hit I got from getting a laugh was in first grade. I don't even remember what it was that I said, but the whole classroom laughed, and the teacher even laughed a little bit and kind of scolded me while she was smirking. And I remember kind of thinking, oh, there's a power here. And I think I've always wanted to feel seen and validated. I think that's a pretty common universal thing. And I suppose having a dad who was kind of a checked out, high functioning alcoholic, I wanted attention. And it was also a way to release tension. And there was a lot of tension between my parents. It would never really erupt into yelling or, you know, violence of any kind, but a deep dissatisfaction under the surface where you knew they were not happy to be with each other. And I kind of became my mom's therapist as early as 7, where, you know, she would tell me how unhappy she was in her marriage. And so very early on, I felt like I needed to be the emotional caretaker. And so I suppose humor was just one of the tools that I would use, as well as listening. But very often my mom would kind of go on these monologues, and a lot of times I would just check out. And I think that's where a lot of my addiction to fantasy came in. Fantasy is a definitely been a drug for me for a lot of my life, both negative and positive fantasy, you know, grandiosity, sexual fantasy, catastrophizing, you know, they're all ways to not be present, to not be here, to not feel the difficulty of being alive.
Yeah. I mean, there are two points from that kind of struck out at me. I mean, the first one is at 7, that's quite a responsibility and burden. I don't know whether burden is the right word, but that's quite
I think burden's yeah. a good word. That's a really shitty thing to dump on a kid. You know, my mom just, she didn't have boundaries. I'm sure it has to do with the way she was raised. She was deeply, deeply abandoned by both of her parents. And that doesn't make, you know, the things that she did okay, but I can have some compassion and understanding for the wounded adult that she is. But I had to learn to protect myself so I could manage my mental health, manage my addictions, you know, manage my ability to get out of bed and smile.
Yeah. And at age 7, what was managing that burden? What did it look like?
Being focused on what my mom was feeling and asking, what does she need? Does she need someone to listen? Basically, all the things that my father should have done.
Right. Wow, that's a very mature outlook for a 7-year-old. I'm not sure most of us would actually have that, I don't know, intuition.
I don't know if it was an intuition as much as a survival thing, because, you know, when you're seven and your mom is sobbing, telling you that she's tired of you selfish bastards, you know, your father and you and your brother, and that she just wants to leave all of us, you want to keep the family together. You know, you don't know that at that point that your mom is being dramatic, that she's mentally unwell, that this is not something you say in front of a child. I didn't know any of those things. So for me, it was, I need to step up for my survival, for this family to become intact. So it I don't think it was out of any sense of altruism. I think if anything, there was a part of me very, very buried into my subconscious that hated my mom for putting me in that position. And I think that drove a lot of my behavior, womanizing, and just not wanting to let a woman get close to me for decades. I couldn't really unpack that until I looked at the ways that I was abused by my mom. Not to punish her, because most of this stuff that I went through, I never even confronted her about it. It was through therapy and support groups. So yeah, it's being somebody who is empathic it's a gift and a curse, because you take on people's feelings. I can be in a room with somebody and almost immediately see who's in distress. You know, if I see somebody hurt another person's feelings, especially unintentionally, where the other person doesn't even know they owe that person an apology, I always feel it upon myself, you know, to go make that person feel better, to do something to, you know. And in some ways, yeah, that's great. It can make the world a better place. But in a lot of ways, it's a really draining way to go through life, to not just... Because sometimes you just need to let other people be in their pain and figure it out themselves, instead of feeling like you need to be everybody's Sherpa. Because even at my best, I can't be somebody else's Sherpa. I could be a friend, but I can't save anybody. And it took me, I think, getting sober and being in support groups to realize, oh, I'm not as powerful as I think I am. I'm actually a little grandiose and a little self-obsessed.
Yeah, that's so. It's so interesting you said that, because a bit about my background. I used to suffer from clinical depression for just slightly over a decade. And I think that's the one thing I learned, you know. I used to be upset and angry at all the relationships in my life who couldn't appreciate my pain and didn't want to carry that burden with me. But I think over time, I realized that it wasn't their burden to carry, you know. It was, if they had the capacity to help, then that's wonderful for me. But to expect it of others, I think, was the wrong mindset for me to go in. And I think that kind of hurt some of my relationships. And now in hindsight, I reflect on that. I think that's the most important thing I've learned, and something that I always try to remind others of, because, you know, relationships, as much as we crave it, we shouldn't expect it. We expect the same level from others if they didn't come in with that same contract, if you will. Yeah,
because there is a fine line between opening up to somebody and draining them.
Yeah, it's and I mean, is that why? Because I notice it's a general theme for many comedians, right, to use comedy as a way to heal both themselves and others. Was that a guiding light for you? And is that why you devoted it? You know, you devoted a big chunk of your life to you know,
comedy? I think I just wanted to be seen. I think I just wanted to be validated. I don't think I ever thought about it in terms of healing. I did, my dad tried to kill himself in 1992. And I remember writing a comedy bit kind of tangentially about that, because it was right around Christmas time. And I wrote this poem about Christmas that was very dark. And I started performing it on stage in my stand-up. And of course, a lot of people have some strong feelings about not liking Christmas, and this tapped into it. And so I remember feeling like, well, I got something good out of it. You know, and that was, I suppose, one of the first times that I thought, you know, art can be a real silver lining to the shit sandwiches we encounter along the way.
Yeah, that's so true. You know, like, and it makes you wonder, like, these are all, they are our natural mechanisms to deal with the shit sandwiches in our life, really, you know, to make ourselves laugh, to make ourselves smile. And mm-hmm. to mirror that to others, which I guess naturally brings me to the next question I had, because you speak really openly about, you know, going through depression and alcoholism, you know, and well, I guess before that, you know, when did you realize that you were suffering from both, and you know, when did it start to become a problem?
I think in 1999, I would have been, 36 at that time. The depression really started to get bad, and I started losing a lot of weight. Not intentionally. It's weird, too, when your depression kills your appetite and you start getting really skinny and people start telling you how great you look. Like, again, it's like, I suppose there's a silver lining there. They don't know that here I am at my birthday party just wishing everybody would leave so I can just be alone in silence. Because to be around people when you're clinically depressed is, it's like trying to bench 500 pounds with your face. Because you know people can see it in your face. They can see it in your eyes. I recognize it all the time in people, that just that that sad kind of emptiness. It's a look I know very, very well. And I'm sure other people saw that in me when I was working on the TV show back then. I had all the stuff on paper that should have made me happy according to society's expectations. But I just, everything felt like an effort. And when they would yell cut on a take, I could just feel my face drop, you know, just like, oh, okay, I've got 2 minutes now where I don't have to fake a smile. And I didn't know at the time that that was depression. I just thought, oh, I'm lazy, I'm ungrateful. And that's one of the side effects of depression, that you don't realize it unless you have it. There are so many ripples to depression. Andrew Solomon, who wrote The Noonday Demon, has written really, really eloquently about depression. Said in a speech that he gave, the opposite of depression isn't happiness, it's vitality. And I thought, that is so true. When we experience a lack of vitality, the first place we go to is beating ourselves up. I'm lazy, you know? And so if managing my depression over the years has taught me anything, it's to not automatically go to the cut myself down. And so, because I know I'm not a lazy person, well, I might not have the greatest work ethic of people I know, but when I'm inspired by something, I work really hard at it. And so I look at it in terms of I'm feeling inspired or uninspired.
Right. I can connect with that. That's really relatable. And one example of that for me was that the height of my depression was during my university phase, and that was
which
also,
is really common, by the way.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and that's something I try to bring light to, because you know it shouldn't be the case. You know, especially if you have the ability to address it. And that was the time where I had a failed suicide attempt as well. But in that period, you know, when I was, you know, criticizing myself for, you know, not having, you know, in Andrew Solomon's words, the vitality, I wasn't focused on the part where I was able to write a book within a year, because I was just inspired to tell a story. And you know, you always forget that sometimes.
Congrats on that, by the way. And
thank you.
And congrats on making it out of the darkness.
Thank you. Yeah. It was an interesting period for me, because as I was suffering, there were parts of me that was actually alive and feeling empowered. But I chose not to notice it, because the pain on the other side was too painful and unbearable. And I think that's what so many of us go through, right? We really shove aside the wonderful parts of our lives because that suffering is too painful. So I suppose what I'd like to understand from you is, how did you solve it for yourself? How did you try to get help and get over these challenges?
Well, the first thing I did was go see a psychiatrist, because I knew something was wrong. My life on paper was something I should have been enjoying, but I couldn't feel it. And I started taking meds, but I was also still drinking. So the meds weren't really that effective. A couple of years sober, a couple of years later, the psychiatrist said, look, if you're not going to stop drinking, I can't treat you anymore, because we're wasting our time. And so I did get sober and I got help. And that's where I began to address my spiritual and emotional struggles that needed to be managed. My selfishness, my anger, my catastrophizing, my playing the victim, you know, all of those things. So then I began to feel a vitality. I began to feel hope return. And that's when I just began unpacking. You know, I started going to a second support group to deal with fear of intimacy and childhood trauma. And that helped me get to an even deeper understanding of what was going on inside of me and the areas that I needed to grow in. I realized how terrified I was of vulnerability. But it all really started with stopping the drinking. It's one of the reasons why I always say on the podcast, if I'm reading a survey that somebody filled out and they've got a litany of struggles, and one of them is an addiction, as I always say, you got to get that one under control first, because it is impossible to, you know, steer that ship when it's on fire.
Yeah. It's interesting, because your psychiatrist said, you know, he's not going to treat you if you weren't going to be sober. But, and then you said you became sober, but I can't imagine that being as easy as the words you mentioned.
No. Yeah. It took months of, you know, fuck him. I'm only going to have one beer tonight. Okay. I'm on my 10th one tonight. All right. You know, we threw that plan out the window. So I had to experience the truth of my powerlessness over drugs and alcohol to be willing to do something, you know, to ask for help. And in doing so, I found a community of people that showed me that it is possible to have fun without numbing myself, without self-medicating. Because, you know, if you're a depressive, putting depressants into your body every day is really not a great idea. I wish I could drink like a normal person, but I can't, and I accept that fact. So sobriety has been a big step up in terms of me being able to find contentment in my life. It's still a struggle. I wouldn't say that I'm a joyful person. I experience moments of joy, but I would say that I'm a peaceful person with a active, unpeaceful mind talking to them all day long.
I like that. And could you explain the difference between being joyful and being peaceful, at least in your words?
Well, joy to me comes and goes. And I can sometimes find joy through maybe sitting in the backyard, you know, listening to the birds, petting my dog, being with my girlfriend. I know people who exude joy all day long. I'm not one of those people. It's a struggle for me to keep a perspective that keeps me from becoming cynical or afraid. And to me, they're one and the same, because I believe cynicism is a byproduct of fear. It's a way of trying to protect ourselves. But peace is doable for me. Since I got sober 17 years ago, it's probably my most consistent positive feeling, because peace doesn't really require much beyond acceptance. You know, acceptance is not approval. I don't approve of our current political climate and political system, but I accept that I can't control it. And so then I can move on and notice the birds, pet my dog, talk to my girlfriend, be able to listen. But if I feel like, oh, I got to go change the political system, you know, and God bless people who do get up and actually do stuff. I don't do much beyond voting. And I'm okay with that. I don't shame myself for that, because that's mentally, that's all I feel I can have on my plate. But sorting out what I have control of and what I don't have control over, and letting the latter go, is a really great way to find peace, because then I can bring principled action to the things I do have control over. And that builds my self-esteem. And then having self-esteem, for me, helps me relax, because it quiets that voice in my head that's like, you're a lazy piece of shit. You're not doing enough.
Right.
So it quiets those two things, quiet the two loudest voices in my head, which are the one that calls me lazy and the one that says, you're going to die because this is all going to burn.
Okay. Wow. Pete, I like what you said about being peaceful really is tied a lot to acceptance. And that's, yeah. and that's such a powerful point, because, you know, I think a lot of the suffering we bring onto ourselves is the need to control the uncontrollable. Mm. Or the need to try and control some element of the uncontrollable. And that's painful in and of itself. So yeah.
And one of the ways that I think we try to control it is to hold on to a resentment and to feel self-righteous and indignant about it. And that's its own kind of drug. I mean, if you go to Facebook, you see it instantly. One of the reasons I'm not on Facebook is because I don't want to get drawn into thinking that I can change people. I can't. I can only change how I react to the world. And so I try not to have toxicity around me. I have friends who disagree with me politically, but I don't talk about it with them, because I know we're not going to change each other. And we are very, very far apart in how we think problems should be solved and what the problems are, what the prioritization of our current problems are. But I can still love that person while not respecting their political views, internally not respecting them. I don't outwardly disrespect them. You know, I have neighbors who have drank the Kool-Aid And I just focus on the fact that they're nice people.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I imagine it sometimes is, I think, well, in the world of chemistry, in the world of physics, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Throughout the universe, almost everything has its opposite. And so why wouldn't that apply to human beings and our opinions and feelings about things? And so I try to imagine a proton getting upset at an electron and think, well, that's kind of a waste of time. Why don't you just focus on doing your thing as an electron and let the proton do its job? Maybe the world needs both of you for some larger goal that you can't see, or maybe it's all a big fucking waste of time. But the former brings me a sense of peace. So whether I'm lying to myself or not doesn't really matter. What matters is the end result, which is I'm an easier person to be around, and I have a more peaceful day.
Gotcha. Yeah, I can relate to that. I have a question, because you're speaking about, and congratulations on 17 years being sober.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. During that period when you were trying to stop and stop yourself from drinking, what were some examples of being self-compassionate and compassionate to yourself as you tried to get through that hurdle?
I don't think there was any compassion until I got some sobriety underneath me. It was only then that the fog kind of lifted and I saw what I had been up against in my alcoholism, and I could see how outmatched I was. And so I was able to let some of the blame go and not just say, it's all, just a personal weakness on my part. I could see I was up against a disease that talks to me in my own voice and warps reality. But I also had to take responsibility for my actions, because somebody you were a dick to when you were drunk doesn't really care that you were an untreated alcoholic. They just want to feel respected. And so I feel like I did a pretty good job of going back and apologizing where I could and trying to do better and try to see where the truth was. And it's where I really found out that in many ways I'm a frightened 10-year-old boy in an adult's body. And for me, sobriety, a very, very small part of it is the not drinking or doing drugs. A much larger part of it for me, it's finding what's the appropriate tool for a situation when I feel sideways. Is it an apology? Is it withdrawing from a situation? Is it cutting someone out of my life? Is it having a difficult conversation? Is it just having compassion for someone and not doing anything? It's not always easy, but the longer I at least have that mindset, the better I feel I get at picking the appropriate tool for a situation.
Right. Interesting. And then when you found yourself in support groups, what did that do for you? And for people who have never been to a support group, what is that experience like? What does it look like?
It can depend on the support group. It can depend on that a particular meeting on a particular day, because I've been to support group meetings where I've said, wow, I'm never going back to that one. That was a shit show. I was not a big fan of anybody in there. And it didn't feel like there was any help being given there. It felt like it's just a bunch of people bitching about their lives. And not that we can't ever bitch about our lives, but there needs to be some type of hope and, sorry, my dog's barking, some type of sense of recovery of people who are further down the path, helping those who are coming after them. And I was fortunate enough to find that in my very first meeting. And so that lit a fire in me that I could see these people were experiencing the feelings that I had wanted to feel my whole life. being comfortable in their skin, laughing, being affectionate with each other. All the things that I just felt were out of my grasp. And so I started doing what they suggested, the things that worked for them, you know, making coffee or putting chairs away, you know, shaking the hands of somebody who's coming to their first meeting, whatever it was. And I began to realize how self-obsessed I was. And yeah, I could be a nice guy, but as I look back, it was a lot of times it was because it was convenient. You know, I have a friend in the support group, and it might not be his saying, but I heard him say it. He said, service begins where convenience ends. And I really like that. I really like that. What? But, you know, I still have an alcoholic voice in my head that tells me, oh, don't go be a service. That's going to be a hassle. Let's just stay right here on the couch and watch episode 7 of the thing that you've watched the other 6 episodes of this afternoon.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, that's a good point and good quote that your friend made. But how difficult is it, or is it easy, when you help someone else go through the same pain that you went through? Does it make your recovery easier? Because
100%. It's a momentum, a spiritual momentum that re-energizes everything. It shifts my perspective on my life and my problems. It gives me a sense of community. It improves my self-esteem. It gives me a sense of purpose. It changes everything. It changes everything. But that voice in my head still tells me, oh, don't go do that. Don't go help that person. Don't go give them a ride to the meeting. It's so out of your way. They're going to be boring. There's going to be traffic.
Yeah. that's I suppose that is the thing that probably gives us the most inertia, right? It's not so much that we don't want to help. It's because we don't know what that process is going to look like for us, that mm-hmm. discomfort and the awkwardness.
The fear of the unknown.
Exactly. You
know, the broken crystal ball telling us how it's going to unfold and be a shit show. And if I listened to the voice of alcoholism in my head, not only would I probably be dead or wishing I were dead, I would have missed out on so many beautiful experiences of human connection that I could not have predicted. And those are the things that make it a little bit easier for me to trust that there might be some benevolent force in the universe.
Yeah. Is it ever triggering though when you try to help someone else? I mean, because their experience can, you know, affect the way you feel about things.
I wouldn't use the word triggering. I would say that sometimes I get tired of addicts and alcoholics, because untreated and alcoholics are in many ways children. They're emotionally volatile. They're self-centered, they're hypersensitive to criticism. These were things that doctors 100 years ago all agreed upon, doctors that worked with untreated alcoholics. So being around people like that can be draining sometimes. And I know that deep down, they're doing the best they can. They're battling a disease that is bigger than them. Their perspectives are warped. They're frightened. They haven't really grasped the tools yet that can help them. And many of them never will, because they don't want to do the work involved, or they're mentally or emotionally incapable of being honest with themselves. But I can have compassion and resentment for them both at the same time.
Yeah, that's true.
And probably some of that resentment comes from recognizing that selfishness and immaturity in myself, because that certainly hasn't disappeared since I got sober. I'm just a little bit more aware of it and occasionally nip it in the bud faster than I used to.
Yeah. And that's a good point, because I suppose 7 times out of 10, you know, the things we hate in others are oftentimes the things we personify as well. So yeah. So this episode is going to air next month, because next month, October 10th is Mental Health Day. And what?
I thought you were going to say next month is Drunk Asshole Month, so we're going to highlight you.
No, I wouldn't be so cruel. I'm because I really enjoy your podcast, The Mental Illness Happy Hour, and we'll talk about that towards the end. But one of the thoughts that you brought up, on your Twitter feed from one of the episodes, was that the more difficult it is to talk about, the more valuable it is for people to hear it. And I want to just delve deeper into that, because I really think, you know, speaking about it in a more meaningful way can really help the cause. But maybe you can explain it in from your experience and your thoughts on it.
Well, I discovered it in support groups, and support groups were a big inspiration for me starting the podcast. Because they helped me with my drinking and drugging. And I thought that sense of community and just sharing stories with each other was so healing and entertaining to me. I thought, well, why can't we do this around mental illness? You know, I'm not going to present myself as a solution for anybody. I'm don't imagine myself as a guru, a person with the answers. But what I can do is I can facilitate conversations. And the hope is that it can bring comfort and maybe even entertain people who are feeling alone, afraid to ask for help, thinking that they're terminally unique and that there's no hope for them. Because I knew what it felt like to be that person that was close to suicide. By the time I finally asked for help, I was thinking about suicide 20, 30 times a day. It was my exit door that was always in the back of my mind. And it just felt like it was getting closer and closer. So starting the podcast was a way for people to see that modeled, people opening up, people talking about the things that are difficult to talk about. One of the things that shocked me in support groups was how awesome it feels when somebody tells a fucked up story and we all roar with laughter because we've all been there and we can laugh because it's behind us. You know, that is one of the greatest things about being in a support group is the camaraderie of shared experiences. You know, our experiences might not be the same externally, but internally, our experiences are the same. Shame, regret, frustration, grandiosity, self-pity. I mean, these are all things that I began recognizing as other people shared their stories. So I wanted to create that by talking about mental illness, because I'd gotten fooled by my depression again. I'd gone off my meds in 2010 and wanted to kill myself, and suddenly realized, oh my God, this is the depression coming back. How the fuck did I get fooled by this? I've been in therapy and seeing a psychiatrist and sober and talking about my feelings all day long. And I believe depression is a real thing. Think about all the people out there that don't even believe that mental illness is a real thing, that you just need to pray it away. I thought they are up against incredible odds at ever truly facing the reality of their mental battle. And I thought, you know, a podcast would be a really good medium, because you can make an episode as long as you want. Nobody's going to censor it. We can have fucked up jokes in it. We can make it as dark as we want. We can make it as light as we want. But more than anything, it's going to be honest. It's going to be honest. And for some people, it's a little too heavy. There are episodes where they're just like, man, I had to turn it off. That was just too heavy. And I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, there's times that I wish I could turn it off. And that's why I started taking Julys off a couple of years ago. But sorry, I'm going off on tangents. That's where I realized the support groups is where I realized the power of speaking the difficult.
Yeah. It sounds liberating, if nothing else.
Yeah, it was.
Through my experience, you know, hosting this podcast, and I suppose by extension, my mental health journey as well, is that at the end of the day, I think we are all uniquely common, you know?
Our experience. That's such a great way of putting it, Nick.
Yeah.
Common.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. I'm so stealing that.
Sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
You will get zero credit.
It's okay. I'll stalk your Twitter and say, hey, that's me. No, but
block. Block.
But feel free to use it. Yes. It's true because, you know, we all have these like unique experiences, but the theme and the emotions and the insecurities and the fear and all of that are common, you know? And so while the stories may differ, it shouldn't hinder us from sharing it because people can still appreciate the overall sense because they've experienced it before. And so, you know, I think, you know, I'm glad that there are people like you who do what you do because you not only do you share your story, but you encourage other people to share theirs. And that's, I think, is the most important thing.
Oh, well, thanks, Nick. That means a lot to me. One of the things that's nice about living in Los Angeles is you get to see some of the people whose lives you envied roll in and talk about all of their internal torture and the, once again, showing how alike we really are. And that was another one of my goals in doing the podcast, was to have people who are in the public eye as guests right alongside a listener or somebody who isn't in the public eye. So you could see that their internal battles were so similar. You know, we're all dealing with shame, regret, self-loathing, you know, wanting validation, wanting to feel love, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be authentic.
Yeah. I would like to end this podcast with a reflective question, you know, with the experience you have and the job that you have. You know, what's one life lesson that has taken you the longest to learn?
Don't have French fries delivered.
You don't like them soggy?
Why is that one thing that has been most valuable? I would say that the process of becoming the person that you want to be is usually less about you becoming different things, and it's more about letting go of things that you don't need anymore. Who you feel you need to pretend you are, people in your life who's, you know, who negatively impact you emotionally. It's mostly a process of letting go of things. But that can be really hard, especially if we want to control and we want to save people and we want to look good and we don't want anybody to be mad at us. So for me, that's been the biggest surprise. Because, you know, look at a kid, look at a one-year-old kid. Everything that we look for in a human being, in a friend, is already being shown there in that one-year-old kid. They can be present. They can giggle. You know, they can be affectionate. Yeah, they can cry and be a pain in the ass. But I think a lot of that stuff is born inside of us, but the world makes us put armor on over it. And I heard somebody say in a support group one time, the coping mechanisms we developed as kids became our character defects as adults. And so it's a process of letting go. This no longer serves me, pushing everyone away. It saved me as a kid, but today it's causing me to be lonely. So yeah, I would say that.
Right. I like that. If I could rephrase, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I suppose what you're alluding to is it's not about adding more to your life, but it's about becoming less, but becoming less and better.
Yes, letting go of the parts of your life and yourself that no longer serve you.
Awesome. That's powerful. I like that. Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, and thank you so much for spending time with me today.
My pleasure, Nick. You're a really, really easy guy to talk to.
Yeah, I pride myself on that.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, for my listeners who are interested in your podcast, maybe you want to share with them, you know, what it is and where they can find it.
That's a very private question, Nick.
All right, then we'll end it now.
It's called the Mental Illness Happy Hour. And it's a weekly podcast. Episodes are usually around hour and a half long. It's an interview sandwiched in the middle. And on the other sides of that are me reading surveys that were filled out anonymously by listeners about sometimes deep, dark secrets, sometimes funny, fucked up things that have happened to us, and everything in between.
Yeah. And I've listened to a few before getting on a conversation with you, and the part where I really like, and something that, you know, most podcasts don't have the luxury or have the ability to do, is to make it interactive, even though it's technically one or two way, you know, but because you have that survey and you speak about a common experience, everyone can kind of participate in a way. And I think that's something you guys would really enjoy. So yeah, do check it out when you can.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thanks so much for being on this show. And, you know, I look forward to having you back at some point.
I'd be happy to.
Awesome. Cheers.
Cheers.